Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. And I do know now it is the 9th of March. Our guest this hour wrote a piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine section last Sunday. Roger Lowenstein is with us. The piece is titled Broke Town USA. And he looks at Vallejo, a city about 25 miles north of San Francisco, which he says in the opening sentence offers a sneak preview of what could be the latest version of economic disaster. When the foreclosure wave hit, local tax revenue evaporated, and financing for the local museum, the symphony, and the senior center went whoosh. The city begged the public employee unions for pay cuts, all to no avail, and in May of 2008, Vallejo filed for bankruptcy. And he also talks about a lot of other places. The city council of Harrisburg, the capital of Pennsylvania, has enlisted a big New York law firm to explore bankruptcy as a means of restructuring a crushing debt. Central Falls, Rhode Island, is in receivership. Hamtramck, Michigan, a small city within Detroit's borders, says it could run out of money next month. So we're going to be talking about municipal bonds and declaring yourself bankrupt and the fragile health of cities all over the United States this hour of the program. Roger is a former reporter with the Wall Street Journal. He is author of 5 books. 3 of them are New York Times bestsellers. Buffett, When Genius Failed, Origins of the Crash, While America Aged, and The End of Wall Street. He writes for the New York Times Magazine. He's a columnist for Bloomberg, a contributor to other publications as well. And the 4th book that he wrote, While America Aged, looked at pensions and also the development of public sector unions. We're going to welcome phone calls for Roger, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hi, Roger.
Hey, Kathleen. Good morning.
Welcome to Wisconsin. Do you have anything you'd like to say about what's going on in our state?
Yeah, what is going on in your state? Where are the Democrats? Where's the government? Where's the governor? I mean, you certainly have the attention of the rest of the country or a goodly part thereof, and we're all, you know, very interested to see what will happen to collective bargaining and how the whole brouhaha will shake out.
So are we. And what's going to happen to cities in our state as well? Well, how many cities in the country are facing economic disaster or have already faced economic disaster?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define disaster. But, almost every city is facing severe budget pressure. So that, if you're one of an employee or a taxpayer or maybe a kid in a home that used to be checked in on by social service people because, you know, there might have been something amiss. I mean, anyone who needs the city service, you're facing a form of disaster. And every city has seen their tax revenues plummet due to the recession, and they come back only slowly. And they've also seen aid from the states cut back pretty severely. For a while, of course, the federal government was propping up the states with stimulus funds, but that's going away now. So every city is really in a crunch, I think.
Mm-hmm. You concentrate the beginning part of the article on Vallejo, which we didn't pay perhaps enough attention to, and we should have looked at that more carefully.
Yeah, I mean, Vallejo is this town in California near San Francisco. It's basically a blue-collar city. They had a naval base there, and that closed down 15 years or so ago. And the town had been hard-pressed ever since then. They tried to develop the naval base into condos for well-off commuters, and that didn't take. And it was also ground zero, really, for the subprime mortgage boom. And so when the mortgage bust came, Vallejo's revenues just plummeted. Foreclosed homes don't pay taxes and so on. And, their revenues evaporated. And they faced really what I call a test of political will. And that's really what what is happening in every city around the country. When I say political will, do people want services? And if so, do the elected officials have the political will to assess people for the taxes to pay for the services that they want? In California, that's particularly tough because you need a referendum. And the city fathers are recognizing how against taxes the people were, refused to even put measures on the ballot. And they went to the unions who gobble up the lion's share of what the city spends, and mm-hmm. they refused. Three, four times they asked them for wage cuts, and they basically, the union said, look, we'll defer the raises you promised us, but, you know, if you want us to take a pay cut, forget it. And this is a town where the average cop is making more than $100,000, and it's not a well-off town. These were salaries approved to approved during the boom years. Finally, the government of Laho had no choice. They filed for bankruptcy, just like an auto company or a private entity that can't pay its bills. They couldn't meet payroll, and it's sort of played out since then. This is a few years ago. As a set piece for what might happen to cities that don't pay enough attention to their budgets and that don't have the political will to make ends meet.
What about this? We were talking to a Milwaukee historian last hour about what's going on in Wisconsin. Whatever happened to this idea in this country? It was certainly prevalent in Wisconsin and in the city of Milwaukee in various times in history that, you know, we're all in this together. There are certain things that we want. We want to be fair. We're all going to have to pay our fair share here. We want certain kinds of services. This is how we're going to take care of it. But there's a common good. Where is the common good?
Well, the rest of the country is actually not that progressive. I got this for you. At least it's not as that progressive anymore. I think one thing that happened was that there were some excesses on the government side, as there obviously were in the private side. We don't need to be reminded of that.
Right.
So, when people see maybe people fattening their pensions by doing a lot of overtime in their last year, so that gets kneaded into the system, or they switch jobs in their last year and their pension gets based on that, and all these tricks, they I think rebel sort of en masse against public employees and public services. I mean, it's astonishing to me to see, comments from teachers who are making $34,000 a year who are saying, I read of one in the New York Times who's got to run off home to her folks in Colorado or someplace because, if the cuts go through, she can't make it. When did $34,000 a year teachers become an enemy? But I think when people in the private sector are so struggling, when they see people in the public sector with benefits that maybe kick in or definitely kick in earlier, say pensions, than retiring in their late 50s or something than people in the private sector have, they're not so willing anymore to pay for that. And for reasons that go back to, Ronald Reagan and maybe some of the failures of the Great Society, the progressive spirit obviously is ain't what it used to be in Wisconsin and elsewhere in this country.
Mm-hmm. You write about, and I'd like some more information about how we got these, the history of these, how many people are invested through their mutual funds, municipal bonds, and you worry about if they were to default, which would cause investors great, great harm. Talk about the role of municipal bonds in cities and how they've been able to fund, the highways and important kinds of structures.
Well, it's almost like it's similar to what happens in a business. For their ongoing expenses, they rely on tax receipts to pay the policeman and the people who work in City Hall and so on. But if they want to build a bridge or a highway or, say, a hospital authority wants to expand put a new wing on the hospital or, all sorts of those types of projects, you can't do that out of budget, so you borrow. And you pay interest on those borrowings, and so for investors, generally they feel pretty safe. The city of Milwaukee wants to borrow money. The city of Milwaukee is not going away. It's a pretty good credit risk, and always has been. And the government makes those makes the interest on those bonds tax free, which makes it even sweeter. And so these investments are owned really by mom and pop investors around the country. It's a sizable market, about $3 trillion. And that's one reason, by the way, why I think it'd be very unlikely to see a lot of Vallejos, because when a town, you know, should a town think about defaulting on its bonds, they're not defaulting on, you know, some strange financial creature far off in Wall Street or around the world. The bondholders are you know, individual citizens, you know, most of them in their own state. So they'd be defaulting on their own people.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the burden of municipal woes, you ask, what if the burden of municipal woes falls elsewhere than on the bondholders? What are you talking about?
Well, there have been some reports that cities are going to go file bankrupt, like Vallejo, you know, en masse, and that there's going to be a sort of a, you know, it's natural to think. We saw what happened in the mortgage bust. One bank goes, the next goes, and so on. So there have been some scare stories that there are going to be a wave of municipal defaults, and that bondholders, creditors to cities would suffer just like mortgage lenders suffered. And what the story points out is that bondholders aren't the only constituent of cities. Unions, their employees are constituents. People who receive services from them in, you know, all sorts of ways are constituents. Taxpayers are constituents. And by law, generally the first dollars that come into a city have to go out to pay bondholders. So it's really only in a case of extremis that they would default. The first things they do are exactly what we're seeing. They cut salaries. They lay off workers. They don't repair potholes as frequently. They expand classroom sizes. You know, a million other things like that. The bondholders are really the last ones to get nicked, and what we're seeing now are, you know, taxpayers and recipients of services and employees getting nicked first.
In order for all of this to get a lot better, are we going to need some kind of dramatic shift? And I wonder if you see it starting in the economy. We need a better tax base everywhere.
Well, we need a stronger tax base, and that part will happen, you know. I mean, sort of naturally, as the economy improves, that revenues are coming back, although they're coming back slowly. And you know, but your question really begs another question. I mean, you say for things to get better. So, what do you mean by better? And that really goes back to your early question. You know, what about the progressive spirit, or at least the spirit of government doing things for the group?
Right.
And so the question, you know, do we still want that? I mean, I point out in the story that Governor Christie in New Jersey killed a bridge to go under the Hudson River. I used to live in New Jersey, and I commuted, you know, on trains that crossed that river. And believe me, they need a new tunnel. And so the story asks the question: look, if we're not going to have government build a bridge, you know, maybe some things the private sector can do, but who's going to build their own bridge?
Right. So, that's a good question.
You know, what do we mean by better? Are we still willing? There's a story in the paper today about a very wealthy town in a New York suburb where they all want their kids to be learning Mandarin in the sixth grade, but nobody wants to pay for the teachers to do this. So, you know, we sort of have to have the summon up the, I think, the political will to pay for what we want, or I don't see it getting better.
Yeah. Well, some of the things are going to, you mentioned the potholes, that's on our minds today as we're driving through town, and yet another snowstorm, and the roads are really awful. I mean, there are a lot of potholes, and they show up this time of year, certainly, but they're pretty bad, and I'm thinking about the amount of money that's going to have to go to firefighters and police officers and their pensions and health care in this city, and what's happening with aid to municipalities and cities. And I'm wondering, well, everybody would agree you don't want to drive in potholes, but I can't imagine that there's going to be a big hurry to get them fixed.
Well, this is what happens. For a while, there are all sorts of things you can do, you know, to delay the day of reckoning. You can push pothole repairs, you know, off a year or two, or just do fewer each year. You know, in San Diego, which has a terrible pension burden, they're not trimming their palm trees. I mean, that may sound like a trivial item, but they have 30,000 palm trees, you know. But sooner or later, the day comes when there's a bad auto accident or somebody gets hit on the head by a coconut because they weren't cutting those palm trees.
Oh, my gosh.
And you can only, I mean, so conservatives speak sometimes, or everything the government does is a waste. It's not. I mean, and particularly at the local level, what the government does are services that we need and want. And
right.
You can really only put these pothole repairs, you know, off for so long.
Yeah. I didn't even know they trimmed palm trees. I've learned something entirely
That's
new.
Right.
Isn't that something? Let's go back to those wealthy people who want their kids to learn Mandarin. At the risk of being entirely too simplistic here, but I'm looking for answers somewhere to this great mess. What about those people? I mean, if they can afford to send their kids to go to a school where they teach Mandarin, why wouldn't they want to pay for it? Why wouldn't they want to help us out with the potholes, too, while they're at it?
I mean, there's a picture of a guy on the front page whose taxes are $50,000 a year. That's property taxes. So, you know, look, that's a lot of property taxes. I don't know what this gentleman earns, presumably a lot more than that. There seems to be, almost a presupposition that money going to government is bad. I mean, I think that's been, part of the triumph of the right wing, the Republican Party in recent years. I mean, Newt Gingrich tried to shut down. I guess he did shut down the Treasury in the Clinton era in the mid '90s. You know, not for any specific reason, just because he wanted to stop tax receipts from coming in and shut down the government, and then it turned out that wasn't very popular. But they're talking about it again. There's a movement now, which I refer to in the story, about getting states to file for bankruptcy.
And, yeah.
And what do you know? It's the same Newt Gingrich who's behind it. It strikes me as a generalized cri de coeur, just sort of unfocused rage against government. Get them to file for bankruptcy, and we can stop them from doing all these bad things, whatever these bad things are. But when you look at the reluctance of voters to approve taxes, the current is widespread.
Yeah. All right, let's welcome phone calls. We have many of them for you already. Here's our phone number if you'd like to join us. One line is open, 800-486-8655. Roger Lowenstein is our guest. His piece in the New York Times Magazine last Sunday, Broke Town USA. Our email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, Joyce Carol Oates will be joining us. Her latest book is A Widow's Story, a memoir. She writes, "My husband died, my life collapsed." Let's go to phone calls for Roger. Let's start with Jeff in Concord. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. I was compelled to call in because I own a house in Vallejo. I bought it a little over 3 years ago.
Oh.
And I want to give you my perspective on what's happening with this city and what I foresee probably nationwide. But the city has kind of a dour attitude, but it's based on, first of all, the economics that were mentioned earlier. But it has a remarkable setting as well. It's in the North Bay, very easy commutability to San Francisco and Oakland. It's a Zone 17 climate. You don't have to worry about roads heaving and thawing like you do here in the Midwest, so their maintenance fees are
maybe an earthquake once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
But let me just mention one thing quickly. The police... you mentioned how many police were let go when they filed for bankruptcy. If you look up their crime rate and compare it to other major cities, I pulled up Oakland quickly. In every category, it is far less than what Oakland has. It's far less than what Milwaukee has. It's a little bit more than Madison. So what my perspective is, this crisis has shaken out the pretenders, the people who became police officers simply for the money. And the other thing is that there's a lot more community organizations and neighborhood organizations where people are looking after each other rather than handing the responsibility to someone else.
So do you live there part of the year, Jeff? Or
I'll tell you what, I'm going next Tuesday.
Oh, you
I'm
are?
Looking out the window right now and wishing I was there right now.
So you like it? You don't feel as though the services or the place has really gone to hell?
I actually see it as a phoenix rising from the ashes. The people there...
Roger.
A couple of things. One is, I'm not sure that comparing it to Oakland, in terms of the crime rates, is a little apples and oranges, because Oakland is a very big and, in terms of the crime rate, a you know, historically a troubled city. But one of the problems in Vallejo now is there aren't enough, and then the police staffing was cut dramatically. They will not respond to calls for vandalism or even, for what I'm told, the streetwalkers in nice neighborhoods. What you say is true, that there are neighborhood associations picking up the slack in some of these areas. And in San Diego, which I mentioned before, there's something like 56 local districts now where neighborhoods are paying for some of their own park maintenance, in some cases security patrols. So to Jeff, this is, you know, this is a phoenix rising for the ashes, people caring for themselves, doing for themselves. Others might regret the waning or the apparent waning of what was the city government that provided for all. That was the purpose of government. And I think it gets back to, Kathleen, what we talked about earlier. You know, what is better? Do we continue to want a world in which we have vibrant cities and city governments, or is it going to be each neighborhood for itself?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Jeff. I'm glad you were listening. Let's go next to Ron in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I'd like to offer a breath of fresh air.
All right.
To all the strife that's going on within this state. You hear about all these problems with the states and towns running short on money.
Right.
And I think we need to think outside the box and offer something some would call radical, maybe even a crackpot, and that's repeal the constitutional ban on states printing their own money, their own currency. That's been in effect ever since the Constitution was ratified.
Do you know of any states doing this, Roger?
You know, I think there's a town in the Berkshires in Massachusetts that offers some sort of script. I'm sure it's not legally money, but you know, they take it in the stores. I think it's a way to get people to you know, buy locally, the local granola instead of some packaged cereal or something. But I don't think there's been a big movement towards that.
Yeah. He did challenge us, though, to think outside the box. When you do that, what do you come up with for the health of these cities?
Well, you know, I think it was that easy, you know, printing money. You know, lots of countries around, you know, in history have tried to print money. And if you print enough, you know, paper money, you know, people realize it's not worth anything. I think cities are actually working very hard to reduce their costs, to think about which services are really necessary and really desired. And I think the pressure on them from voters is a good thing, because it's sort of putting them to the fire. One of the problems that, particularly in the pension area, the temptation was for cities to make promises which didn't have to be kept, because pensions are long-lived, for years later. And so there was really no check and balances. And what's happening now that budgets are under such stress, is that sense of checks and balances is being reasserted. And mayors and city councils and so on are saying, you know, either we're going to have to raise your taxes, or we're going to have to let so many firemen go, or we're going to have to expand classroom sizes by a certain amount. And, you know, I don't think there's a simple solution to that, but those are the types of decisions that we want government to make. And, one of the problems that we got into before, government was able to pretend that these trade-offs didn't exist, because they could say, you know, we'll give you this pension and we won't really worry about funding it. That'll be the problem of my successor or their successors. So, you know, these trade-offs are hard, but that's why they hold the jobs. That's what government is about.
Mm-hmm. Are pensions in trouble in any of these places, Roger?
Well, pensions are massively underfunded, which means that, you know, the idea of a pension is each year you serve, your benefit goes up. So, you know, you're a teacher, you're a firefighter, whatever. The employer has to put money away, and sometimes the employee puts money away each year, and then it's invested. So in theory, you know, whenever you, for each year you've worked, there's more money invested, and when you retire, the money's there. And what localities have done, particularly in places like Illinois and California and New Jersey and many other areas, is they've said, well, this was a bad year. Let's just skip the pension payment and we'll do it next year. Or maybe they said, the stock market went up so much this year, we don't need to make our contribution. Of course, next year the stock market goes down, and they've got two contributions due, in effect. So there's way, way less money in pension funds than there should be. The reason why I think pensions will be paid in the end is, you know, if you have, a pension fund at a private company, General Motors or something, and it's underfunded and the company goes out of business, there's not enough money. There's some level of federal insurance, but it's not complete, so the workers don't get their pensions. Cities don't go away, and I think at the end of the day, pensions will be paid, but cities are going to have to go back, and they are going back to their taxpayers now and saying, we need you to ante up more, and that's, you know, that's one reason voters are unhappy. It's not a lot of fun to have to pay more in taxes, you know, to make up for past years when governments didn't pay what they were supposed to pay for its pensions.
Bill in Adams. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just calling to the speaker to mention that I agree wholeheartedly with what he's saying. I'm an elected official, and I get to deal with this on a regular basis. But the biggest problem we run into is people don't understand that snowplows and asphalt and gravel and all the things that we need to maintain towns and things of that sort, the prices continue to go up. Yet people have a hard time understanding that to pay for those, taxes have to go up. And then when we do cut services, we get phone calls saying, why aren't the streets plowed? Why? Well, diesel fuel is now up to almost $4 a gallon. So you try cutting back, and you're right. People don't understand that there are give and take that take place. So.
Yeah, and they say, well, gee, what are my taxes for if you're not going to plow the streets?
Right. And if you don't plow the streets, you lose your elected official job. You got to plow the streets, right? At least in the Midwest, you got to plow the streets. I'm sure that's true everywhere.
Bill, thanks for the call, Bill.
Yeah, thanks, Bill, very much for the call. Jeff in Upper Peninsula. Hi, Jeff.
How are you doing?
All right, how are you?
All right, I just wanted to make a comment here as an ex-Chicagoan who now lives up here, okay? Your guest said that conservatives and Republicans seem to be attacking the government. Anything going to the government is bad. And that's not really what Republicans and conservatives are thinking. It's more the waste that they can't stand. You know, the GAO just said that the federal government has all these redundancies and all these different programs, which is just a waste. And being from the city of Chicago, I'll tell you, there is a lot of waste. There's a lot of waste that goes on in the city of Chicago, and it could be much more efficient in what they do, and it would save the taxpayers a ton of money.
Where do you see?
Because of the politicians, they have to keep armies in place, which creates jobs that really are unnecessary.
Where do you see the waste, Jeff?
Well, let's take. There's an old joke, okay, that a woman saw these two guys in the city of Chicago working. The one guy was digging a hole, the other guy was filling it up. And they were working like crazy for 8 hours. So finally she went up to him and said, well, what, you know, you guys are doing a great job, but why is he digging a hole and you're filling it up? They said, well, actually, we know it seems kind of odd, but it's a three-man crew, and the guy who plants the trees is off today.
Okay, what is your name, caller?
Pardon?
Jeff. His name is Jeff.
Jeff, yeah. You know, I don't want to be in the position to defend the city of Chicago's efficiency or lack thereof. But one thing that strikes me, I think, and you mentioned the GAO, is I think the level of waste increases as you get further from localities and closer to the federal government. When you get into a lot of the towns and cities we're talking about, I wrote in the article about you know, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you know, struggling towns in the former, you know, steel-producing region of western Pennsylvania. I think there tends to be less waste and more of what the previous caller said, you know, spending money on gravel, on snow plows, on teachers. I mean, you know, everybody seemed to think the teachers ought to be, you know, higher pay, that we're not rewarding, at least the talented teachers, you know, well enough. I mean, these are basically the things that local governments spend money on. Again, I'm not an expert in Chicago, and if people are digging ditches so other people can fill them up, you know, I mean, they ought to stop it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. That doesn't make sense. You do point to Illinois. Can you tell me a little bit about Illinois, where they've decided to raise taxes and, you know, Wisconsin's been saying move to our state because how in the world can you raise taxes in Illinois? It's not a good thing.
Illinois has had very low taxes. They just had an antipathy towards raising them, and they finally did. So the percentage, I think it's a 2/3 increase in the state income tax, and you know, it's a high percentage, but it's still around 4 or 5%, I think. You know, it's still on the lower end of state income taxes. What Illinois had done for years was they had very lavish state pensions. It's a union. Chicago's a union town. Illinois is a union state. No secret about that. But they just refused to fund them. I mean, they just wouldn't put the money in that they were supposed to. So the latest figures I've seen, the liabilities, meaning the present value of all the pension payments that they're going to come due for people for work that's already been done, is $128 billion, and they've only got half that, $64 billion, in the pension fund. And you know, basically each year they just skip the payment or skip a large part of the payment that was due. Finally, the government has said, they can't do that. I mean, they were doing a lot of other things too. Companies that the state bought services from, they were $8 billion in arrears. I mean, they just, they weren't paying them, or they were paying them late. So there comes a time when you can't delay payments anymore. You can't starve the pension fund all the way down, and they finally did have to raise taxes. They're still, I think a real worry there. They borrowed $4 billion, roughly, to put in the pension fund. And all that does, of course, it's not really making good. It's just saying, well, we'll borrow the money and later on we'll pay it back. You know, pension costs should come out of current expenses. Those $8 billion they were behind on vendors, they borrowed a separate bond issue. And states, really, they're supposed to borrow for the sorts of things we talked about, to build bridges and capital projects. They're not supposed to borrow to pay their bills. So Illinois, I think, really continues, to not meet the test of political will, which is to square its spending with its revenues. Mm-hmm.
Here's an interesting email from Steve in Milwaukee. In this city, in the 2010 adopted city budget, personnel costs amounted to 85.7% of the overall budget. This does not include public school spending. This information found, he says, on page 12 of the City of Milwaukee budget summary, available at public libraries, many now closed on Saturdays and evenings due to budget constraints. Could you comment on how this percentage, a hard to believe 85.7%, compares to Vallejo and other cities and what it might mean for the future?
Well, Vallejo, I know that police and fire are 80%, so you can bet that the total personnel costs are in the same range. It's not that surprising. That's what cities are. They don't, cities don't have armies. They don't buy expensive weaponry. They buy some asphalt. They buy some traffic lights. That figure doesn't include the schools, so we won't count the textbooks that they buy, but they operate City Hall, and the firehouse and so on. But basically, they employ cops, they employ firefighters, they employ surveyors and all the people who work in City Hall. So they provide people who provide services. So their costs are personnel. That's not really so surprising, and it's not really atypical.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Roger Lowenstein is our guest. He has a very interesting piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine last Sunday, and he's the author of many books. He's a former reporter with the Wall Street Journal, author of books including Buffett, When Genius Failed, Origins of the Crash, While America Aged, and the End of Wall Street. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Mike in Ladysmith. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Before I say what I had originally told your screener, I'll just make a quick comment, is that, just your discussion just a minute ago, is it's not surprising to understand where the source of the you know, issues like what Illinois is doing, what we're doing, where would these shortcomings come? Because essentially, the elected administrators, your governors, your mayors, your county executives, have been running Ponzi schemes, what essentially is equivalent to a Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme, and that as long as your economy is growing, so that your tax revenues are, you know, in the case of property values, your property values are growing astronomically, your revenue is coming in faster than your rate of inflation. So when the unions come in and you do your good faith negotiations, you know, you can cover those costs. But then as soon as the economy goes south, then you have a problem. But the real reason I wanted to call in was the earlier caller talked about, you know, the Phoenix rising from the ashes community and how it's really not that bad. Your guests kind of tiptoed around the apples and oranges. I mean, that was apples and bowling balls. I'll tell you, the most communities out there, you have to look at the community nature itself, the nature of the culture in the community. If you have a relatively homogeneous community that, you know, maybe it's higher educated, maybe it's lower educated, but it's relatively homogeneous, and most of the people in that community have a similar background, cultural experiences, it's far easier for them to band together and have the serious discussions about where can cuts be made, you know, and where can we do things more through community outreach and so forth. But when you have large, diverse communities or huge extremes in wealth distribution, that's a much, much more difficult proposition. And that's where the power of the city, the county, the state now is where you get the equalization and you get that representation. And they have to step in and do those services. And you have to enforce some laws. You have to have some laws and you have to enforce them.
Roger.
Yeah, 2 points. Vallejo is not Beverly Hills. It's not Oakland, but it's a blue-collar town. It's not pampered suburb. Secondly, I take issue with the idea that cities across the country have been running Ponzi's.
Yeah.
They certainly, city budgets have been rising with the economy and with rising tax receipts. Basically, they're funded every year from revenues coming in. We tend to, I think, sometimes throw the word Ponzi scheme around loosely, which is, you know, sort of a shell game where you know, I take your revenues and pay someone else, and, you know, there's a chain and so on. They got ahead of themselves, or they set themselves up for a fall by, basing their budgets on revenues that proved unsustainable, at least for a while, when the recession came. The revenues will return to that level, but within, you know, a year or two. But I think Ponzi scheme's unfair. I don't think most legislatures or mayors have been, you know, that dishonest or that deceitful.
Let's go next to Daryl from Exonia. Hi, Daryl.
Hello. I just want to ask him if you think that Wall Street really has changed. You know, the articles that I'm reading about how these companies are selling bonds and the money isn't really even to invest in anything. It's to pay dividends to shareholders because debt is so cheap. They're just creating debt out of nothing. And that who buys these bonds other than, like, pension funds? And if the pension funds are buying these bonds that really aren't backed by anything because they're just taking the money and sending it hedge fund people that have bought the, you know, leverage buyout and bought these companies the first place and they're getting their money back. Well, then these bonds really aren't worth that much. So when the pension fund says, oh, yeah, we got all this money, here's our assets, what really are these assets worth? And has anything really changed in Wall Street? And one other thing I'd like to throw out there, and I'll take
that
out of the air so I don't get it back, but 40% of the properties in some cities are non-taxable. Because they're non-profits, supposedly, like even hospitals, churches, these places that get fire protection, police protection, that aren't paying taxes. And, you know, thinking out of the box, well, maybe you're going to have to start taxing some of these people.
All right. Roger.
If you want to tax churches, good luck. I mean, that's, you're tackling a real tiger. I don't think most electorates would go for it. I think the other question, the first question, was referring to the title of my last book, The End of Wall Street. I think Wall Street has changed, but not as much as
since the crash, as I and others might have hoped. I think it's still too soon to say really how the effects of the bust are going to shake out, but I don't think the excesses now are as great as they were before. In some cases, there are a lot more controls on borrowing, levels of capital, levels of leverage, even on compensation. But we'll see.
Tom in Stoddard, hi.
Good morning, Roger and Kathleen. Yes, I'm just wondering how long it's going to take for the average Americans who are going through all of these problems to realize that they're never going to become millionaires, but they want that option that they can, so they are ready and willing to let all these very rich people get by with all these tax breaks. Back in the Eisenhower administration, the average taxes for the very rich was 90%, and what is it now? Something below 30%?
Right, right. Well, trying to think of which, are we at 35 or 39 now? We're at 35 because the Bush tax cuts are still there. So it's 35.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, this goes back to the sort of values question that Kathleen asked. I mean, in the Eisenhower era and through the Johnson era, the theory was that rich people could afford to pay more and a lot more. And, the theory since the 1980s has been that it's better for society if there's a greater incentive for wealthy and others to put more money to work. And so tax rates have been, dramatically reduced. And I would say, for a long time, that theory had the upper hand because the U.S. could point to other societies, say in Europe, where the government sector was larger and tax rates were higher, and say, we're doing better. Even the people at the lower end of the scale are doing better because of all this tremendous industry investment that the wealthy classes are throwing off, the growth in Silicon Valley, things like that. Now our model doesn't look so good, but even by comparison, and I think there's more questioning, although I don't see tax rates returning to 90% anytime soon.
But eventually, aren't we going to have to say we got to get the money somewhere? There don't seem to be other sources of revenue. We're going to have to go and get it from the people who have a lot more money.
Well, this is what they're arguing about in the Congress. I mean, look, we had a Democratic president who refused to rescind the Bush tax cuts,
mm-hmm.
which he, really campaigned against. This was, right after Obama had commissioned a deficit commission. The deficit commission, said loudly and clearly that tax revenues need to be raised, and he refused to do it. I don't think the trouble with the federal government in particular is the day of reckoning can be delayed for much longer time than cities can, because they can print money and they can borrow. And the federal government is, rather than facing the music by either cutting spending or by raising revenues, it's just continuing to defer the day of reckoning by more borrowing and more borrowing. I don't think, though, the political sentiment is there for anything like the tax increases that caller was talking
about. Right, that's pretty high.
Even getting them up to the old 39%. By the way, this country did terrific when they were that level under Clinton in the 90s. It's remembered as a golden age now. But
yeah.
But try telling that to the Congress.
And tell me, why do you think that Obama refused to up the rates?
I think because any time a Democrat raises any tax by a tenth of a percent, every commercial in the country is going to call him a taxer and spender. And he didn't want that on his resume when he runs for re-election.
Hmm. How about now? Would they still, considering what's going on in Wisconsin and other places?
It'll be very interesting to see what I spoke about the sort of failures of the Great Society, sort of excesses of liberalism. And it's possible that Governor Walker has pushed the conservative pushback too far and will suffer a pushback. I think, Gingrich ran into that, remember, in the 90s when, they shut down the government and, he thought he was a big, whopping success until he was his party was voted out in the next elections. So I think,
you know, this tremendous surge by people like Walker and also Governor Christie in New Jersey, you know, may soon run into the limits of how far the right can go to scale government down.
Thanks, Tom, for your call. Larry in Cottage Grove. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen and Roger. How are you guys doing?
All right, Larry.
I feel that the country is suffering from a term called normalcy bias. Normalcy bias means that even though there's impending disaster, kind of like the Katrina in New Orleans where the city was underwater, but they never thought it could happen, well, you're just in denial of the truth. And the truth is that we have so much fiscal debt that it's almost unsolvable, and everybody pretends that it isn't that bad. Well, I'm 66, self-employed, and I'll never be able to retire. And as far as unions go, about 13.5% of people are represented by unions, and about 9.5% are public service workers. So I feel they plundered the taxpayers, especially in Wisconsin, because it's the most lucrative pension plan in the world for public servants. How can you retire people with million-dollar pensions at age 55 that work 9 months a year? And I don't have anything against teachers. Both my parents were teachers with master's degrees. And everybody thinks that this is normal, and that we're going to come through this. We have so many financial things that are non-sustainable right now. We got to get out of the normalcy bias.
Yeah. It's a good call. I'd like to pick up on one thing that you mentioned, which is that age of retirement, because the average pension, even the average public worker's pension, is not that great. I think the average in the country is something like $27,000. Of course, when you multiply them by all these people, the dollars become large. And then when you do what the caller just referred to, which is you say, we'll start giving them to you at 55, in some states, for some workers, even at 50. Suddenly, you're looking at, being retired from 55, and you keep that to age 65, age 75, age 85. So public servants now are collecting their pensions for 20, 30, even 40 years, in many cases longer than they're working. And when pensions were conceived, the first subway pension in New York City was given to people who reached age 70. You had to be pretty lucky to live that long then. This is back in 1910.
Sure.
And you didn't collect that pension for very long in most cases. So it was a little sinecure at the end of life. We've converted it now to a payment that goes on for several decades, often longer than you work. And that's made it a burden that's just unsustainable. And I think if and understandably unfair in the eyes of taxpayers, because they know that in their jobs they don't get to retire until they're 65 or 67, or in the case of this caller, you know, sometimes ever. So I think, you know, one of the best steps that public entities could take towards reform would be to say, look, in this country, if Social Security kicks in full payment at 67 and the private sector does, that's when we're going to start paying public pensions. Now, in a few professions, you run into trouble. For instance, firefighters, because you can't be running into burning buildings at age
64, right?
And there aren't a lot of desk jobs in fire departments. Police departments are different. There's a fair amount of non-line work that older officers can do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Larry, very much for your call. Jackie is next from Drummond. Hi, Jackie.
Yes, this is a very simplistic question, but this has been on my mind, you know, for several years. You know, both the two wars we're fighting now were really never funded. There's been no war tax, no war bonds, or anything like there was, you know, in the Second World War. And I was just wondering, does the cost of our military trickle down to all the fiscal disparities that even at the local level we are feeling because there's not money from state or national to filter down, or is that just too simplistic a question?
You're talking about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, they are paid for by the government, and the government is borrowing a whole lot. I mean, there may not be, savings bonds with that logo that you may remember from, the 1940s, but the government is paying for it, and they're paying for it with borrowed money. And those wars very much contribute to the total government debt,
and to the debt that you know, our kids and probably their kids will be paying mm-hmm. off for many years to come.
And they've gone on for a long
time. They sure have.
Yeah. Thanks, Jackie, for the call. Mark is next from Fremont. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. My question is about the import tariffs that were put in place to help equate the wages around the world so that American workers could have better pensions and better wages and jobs to pay taxes. And has anybody kicked around the idea of maybe reinstating import tariffs? And
you want to go to talking about trade, huh? You know, sentiment of most economists is pretty much against tariffs because, you know, when we put a tariff on, and I don't have to spin this out for you, you know, Mexico will and England will and Japan will and all of our trade partners will. And this isn't just a theory. I mean, we tried this in the 1920s and early 30s, and we had a world depression. It's really a pretty connected global economy. And if you start putting up those kinds of I think the fact we have to live with is that we're in a global economy.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. Roger, thank you very much. Interesting hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour and on-air production.